It's great to see so many people here in the Zendo today. It's very special. Most of you probably know that Jikoji was founded by Kōpen Shinō Urigawa Roshi, who taught me and some of the rest of you here. Everyone called him Kōpen, and mostly still does. And I think that that already tells you something important about him. It's a level of informality that would be impossible in most Zen temples. It's almost as if Pope Francis insisted on being called Frank. But Kōpen insisted on a certain informality, or really unpretentiousness. He took our practice very seriously, but he refused to take himself seriously. And I think that was an important lesson that he taught all of us. Because of this, our practice here is fairly informal. Some of us wear robes, like I'm wearing, but most don't. And I wonder sometimes if Kōpen himself hadn't been Japanese, if we ever would have introduced these sorts of Zen uniforms here at the temple. They probably felt very natural to him when he was training as a monk in Japan. But of course, there's something artificial about wearing them here, especially when it's this hot. But these are the same robes that I wore when I was ordained by Kōpen 16 years ago. And so I can't quite bring myself to get rid of them. Kōpen stripped down much of the ritual and ceremony around Zen. Although he himself was a master of such things, when he first came to America, he spent his first several years out at Tassajara at the Zen monastery there, which at the time was just starting. And he helped them develop fairly elaborate rituals that are still in use at Tassajara. Our resident teacher here, Michael, once called Tassajara our high church because the practice is so much more formal there. When it came to starting his own temples, like this one, Kōpen was much more relaxed. We have services here, like the one that we just did together, but they tend to be fairly short, without a lot of ceremony. Kōpen didn't dispense with all of the ritual around Zen, but I think he tried to keep only those that really mattered. So one other ritual he kept is these talks. Like formal sitting robes, these talks can seem sort of stiff and awkward at times. There's something a little unnatural about one person sitting, talking to a room. And Zen is, after all, supposed to be a mind-to-mind transmission, explained without words, a practice rather than a philosophy. And so it can sometimes feel pointless and even counterproductive to talk about it. And yet Kōpen talked about it, or tried to, and we've continued that tradition. As some of you know, our Dharma sister, Judy, another of Kōpen's students, has been editing some of Kōpen's talks into a book. And this is a really wonderful service to our Sangha. For those of us who knew Kōpen, it's a chance to connect with him again, to see and hear his words after so many years now of living with his silence. And for those of you who didn't know him, it's a chance to experience his teachings firsthand. I think each of us adapts and changes, experiences the Dharma in our own way. We really can't help it. We're just natural filters. When a teaching passes through us, changes us, but we also change the teaching. So as much as students like me might try to pass on some of Coben's teachings to others, we're really just passing on our own experience of those teachings. So when Judy's book is published, you'll be able to have your own experience. And you can skip all the middlemen and women like myself. I've been lucky enough to read some of Judy's early drafts, and that's really been a great experience. And last month, many of us sat here and read through some of the chapters together. And this was even more special because we could hear Coben's words out loud, sometimes spoken by those who knew and loved him, and sometimes by those who have come to his lineage after his death. One of the lines that stuck with me comes near the beginning, and I've been thinking about it a lot. I just thought I would talk about it a little here today. Coben said, "How to see the life experience of Shakyamuni Buddha is up to you, each of you, according to your own understanding." I'll just read it again. "How to see the life experience of Shakyamuni Buddha is up to you, each of you, according to your own understanding." This was a common theme with Coben, that in the end we have to be our own teacher. And in particular, I have to admit that I find the lessons of Buddha's life sometimes confusing. I'm sure most of you know the basic outline. He was born to a royal family in India and led a pampered life among the very rich. His parents made every effort to indulge him. It was foretold at his birth that he would become either a great king or a great holy man. And his family much preferred the king idea, and so they sheltered him for anything that they thought might lead him down the spiritual path. In early adulthood, he seemed well on his way to spectacular secular success. He married and had a child. He was living the luxurious life of a prince, residing in beautiful palaces built especially for him. And yet at some deeper level, he was unhappy, or at least unsatisfied. Somehow this was not the life he wanted, or the life he felt he was destined to lead. And so eventually, against his family's wishes, he ventured out into the kingdom to meet his subjects. And there he was confronted by their suffering, by sickness, old age, and death. And having seen this, he somehow found it impossible to return to the banalities of palace life. There are parts of Buddha's story that are probably easy for many of us to relate to, and parts that are not. Most of us did not grow up in a palace, but many of us do lead lives of comparative luxury, where we do not need to struggle for our basic needs. And yet we do struggle. We're not at peace. The other thing the Buddha saw when he traveled outside his palaces was a holy man. And so in the end, the Buddha left the palace for good and began a new life himself as a wandering ascetic. Dhishyamana practiced all sorts of austerities, starving themselves, beating themselves, bringing themselves to the brink of death in order to escape the confines of their human forms. And Buddha did all these things too. But after a while, he decided that such harsh practices were not for him. And that's when he started on his middle way, the way between narcissism and asceticism, between self-absorption and self-denial. And he meditated overnight under a Bodhi tree and realized his enlightenment. It's sometimes hard for me to know what to make of this story. On one hand, it's a story of non-attachment and of bodhicitta, the drive for enlightenment. As Buddhists, we hold these out as very positive attributes. Non-attachment is one of our paramitas, the perfections, one of the ways we purify ourselves and our karma. And bodhisattva, the mind that strives toward awakening above all else, is an essential part of the bodhisattva life. And yet at the same time, it's hard not to feel that the Buddha's behavior was somewhat irresponsible. Did he need to abandon his family to find awakening? And if so, why? And what does that mean for the rest of us? Is it possible that he was too non-attached? That his drive to enlightenment was too strong? And is that a risk for us too? Should all of us quit our jobs and leave our families to practice the way? Some do, of course, but most don't. In our Zen tradition, even ordaining as a monk doesn't require us to renounce the world anymore. Is that a mistake? Reading this line in Judy's book of Koban's talks, my mind naturally also went to Koban's own life. And his life, too, often seemed to exemplify a similar non-attachment and bodhicitta. His drive to practice was very strong. And yet he was at times an unfaithful husband and an absent father. How is it possible for a man with so much wisdom and compassion to sometimes cause pain to the ones he loved? And then in the end, he made the ultimate sacrifice for his family, dying in an attempt to rescue his daughter. So was he too attached or not attached enough? These are, in the end, unanswerable questions. And maybe they're not even the right questions to ask. The danger, I think, of focusing too much on the Buddha's life or Koban's life is that it can cause us to become overly focused on our own life stories, too. We all have a story of how we came to practice, some dramatic and some mundane, some tragic, some uplifting. We may not match the Buddha in either his accomplishment or in the pain he must have caused his family, but we all have things we've done that we're proud of and things that make us ashamed. And yet the Dharma teaches us at some level that these stories don't really matter. They are, in the Buddhist tradition, just one chapter in a much longer story, stories that began long before we were born and will continue long after we die. And more importantly, these stories don't define us. We are not our stories. In a sense, the stories aren't even real. The present moment, right here and right now, is the only thing that's real. I've heard the Dalai Lama quoted as saying that there are 2 days when nothing can ever get done, yesterday and tomorrow. And that's true. Our life stories are the stories of yesterday. And so really they are not our stories anymore today. Whatever we have done in the past need not trap us here in the present. The Buddha himself instructed all sorts of students in his years of teachings, rich and poor, young and old, righteous and criminal. And no one's past was an obstacle to their practice. And so maybe that's the answer, that there is no one way to practice. No single set of steps that all of us can or should follow. The Buddha's path led him to renounce his secular life entirely. Coben seemed to find a different way, remaining in the world for the most part with family and friends, but at times leaving them behind as well. And so we must all find that balance for ourselves, and we will probably not get it right all the time. Sometimes we will cause suffering. Sometimes we will alleviate it. But what matters is not the choices we've made in the past, but the choices we make right now. So thank you for choosing to practice with us today. We have a few minutes, so if anyone had questions, you're free to ask.
I'm curious, because we've taken this monastic tradition and then grafted it on to America. And then people come and we want to practice. What do you think a priest is in your life now that you are home?
Well, I'm not sure. There are some, some of the Buddhist traditions here in the West, particularly like the Vipassana traditions, have essentially dispensed with ordination and priesthood, and others like us have maintained it. And I think from the beginning of Buddhism, there's been question about what it means to take on robes, to ordain, and what is the role of lay people versus versus monks and nuns and priests. And in some ways, as the priesthood has evolved, it's gotten even more confusing. I think in our tradition that we think of priests as people who have made a lifelong commitment to the Sangha, to practice, to try to support the Sangha. To try to pass along the Dharma. But of course, those are all things that lay people can do as well. And there are some priests in our tradition who've dispensed with robes and no longer make a distinction. But I think those of us who wear them, we wear them as just an outward sign of this commitment we've made, and as a connection to this long lineage of teachers and practitioners who have brought the Dharma to us. I think that's the best I can do.
There is no present or past, yesterday or tomorrow. Where does the now come from?
Well, I don't know that I know the answer to that. I think one of the things the Buddhists taught is that there are some questions that we can't know the answer to. One of them is sort of where does this world come from? Was it created? Was it always there? Um, but that even though we can't answer, and maybe that's you might think of that as bad news. The sort of good news is that it doesn't really matter, that our practice wouldn't change based on the answer to these questions. So the present is our experience in the moment when we're mindful, when we're awake, aware. We don't really know where it comes from, but we know that we can experience it directly, and through that direct experience of the present moment, we can see the world as it is. And ultimately free ourselves from suffering. That in a sense, suffering comes from that clinging, even clinging to the past, clinging to the future, clinging to anything other than what we have in front of us right now.